Okay, so let us now, without further ado, go on to mantra 15. I actually will read through all the mantras as we've been doing. Mantra 15 is on page 84. So here, the mood, of course, is quite different from what we've been used to. This devotee, the speaker of Shishupanishad, he has been explaining the Ishavasya system in different ways, the value of following it, how to follow it, and also the problems which will arise if you don't follow it. Very serious and very severe problems will arise. So having done like that, anyone not mark themselves present? So having made, you could say, the more philosophical type of presentation, now he, on his own behalf, and setting an example for us also, he is now going to bring it to like the culmination, what it's all going to add up to ultimately. Then we are going to need some mercy. A devotee will always feel like that. We mentioned the other day the story of the Brahman and the cobbler. We've referred to it a little bit on a number of occasions. So you will not find a devotee who, at the time of death, will stand up and say, or lie down and say, that I'm ready. Yeah, I'm qualified. No problem. You won't find. Not really. Not in that sense. We were at Govardhan the other day, and at Govindakund we were talking about Madhavendra Puri, who was a most extremely advanced devotee. Actually, an inhabitant of the spiritual realm who descended just to play some part in the mission of Lord Chaitanya and set the scene for Lord Chaitanya to appear. And it's described quite elaborately in Chaitanya Charitamrita how he was at the time of death. And he was praying or saying that I failed. Praying to the Lord, please help me. That, what have I done with my life? I'm not really qualified. And, of course, the devotees appreciate those feelings of humility. But his disciple, Ramachandrapuri, did not appreciate, so he decided to render some service, supposedly, to his spiritual master at the time of death by giving him some good advice. That, why are you lamenting so sentimentally like this? Why don't you fix your mind on Brahman and become detached? And Madhavendra Puri told him that you get out. If I see your face when I die, I don't know where I'll go. So you please, just go. Whereas on the other hand, Ishvara Puri, he appreciated the glorious position of his spiritual master. And he very humbly and very, in a very proper way, doing everything nicely and doing everything that should have been done, with a very nice attitude, he managed to please his spiritual master at the time of death. And he understood that this is Madhavendra Puri in a mood of very humble ecstasy and pure love of God. So as a result, what happened to him? Well, what happened to Ramachandra Puri was he became an impersonalist, some sort of like a Mayavadi. And Ishvara Puri, what happened to him was he got such mercy because of that nice consciousness that he became empowered to even become the spiritual master of Lord Chaitanya. So Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, he makes that point that we can just see from the results that these two people got, you know, how they were situated and what their real positions were. And Ramachandrapuri, he became an impersonalist, but he was quite deluded about his position. But it was very interesting how he was able to sort of justify a certain type of consciousness which resembled Krishna consciousness, in that he was a very senior devotee and a sannyasi. So therefore he had, as time went on, and you know, he was very elderly devotee amongst the devotees in general. So naturally, for someone in that type of situation, they get a certain amount of respect, naturally, just because of their seniority and their standing. So in that light, he thought, yes, I'm a senior devotee, I'm a sannyasi, so what should I do amongst the devotees? I know, I should help them by correcting them. Whenever I see anything which is wrong, I'll tell them. So, in a sense, that is, there's some validity there. Senior devotees are meant to do things like that. And they had to, actually. But the way he went about it, he went completely overboard. And he started correcting people for things that weren't even wrong. And eventually he tried to correct Lord Chaitanya himself. Anyway, the point we're making is that this devotee here, the speaker, is speaking in a very nice way at the time of death, in a very humble mood, that I'm not qualified, but, you know, I can't, there's no more opportunity to think, right, I've got to improve my rounds. We may still arguably have time to think like that. Got to be more attentive when I chant, got to read more, got to develop more of a service attitude. But when you come to the time of death, then you can't think, okay, now I've got to improve my rounds now. It's too late. So at that time, all you can do is appeal like this, actually. Please, my dear Lord, be kind, be merciful. I know I have many faults. I know I have many faults, and what right do I have to claim a place at your lotus feet? But if you would be kind enough, then please give me such a place. And even if you feel I'm not ready for it yet, at least as I go on from this point after death, as I go on, please lead me so I can continue to make progress in the right direction, so that eventually, at least, by your grace, I can make it. So very, very nice prayers, actually. There are five main points he's making, or requests, actually. In Mantra 15 and Mantra 16, he's requesting to see the face of the Lord, to enter into the direct association of the Lord, and particularly in the sense that he doesn't want to be dazzled by the Brahma Jyoti. Krishna's body is extremely effulgent. The Brahma Jyoti is that effulgence. We all know that devotees, when a devotee is very fired up, like if there's some very dynamic kirtan, or someone has done some very good service, had a big day on book distribution or something of that sort, then they become effulgent. You may have seen devotees sometimes become effulgent. So they're reflecting Krishna, the effulgence of Krishna. They're reflecting the presence of Krishna in their hearts. Krishna is very vividly present in those very intensive devotional situations. And this is even sometimes a hazard if you're doing book distribution. Sometimes the devotees try to disguise themselves on book distribution, but then someone will walk up and say, Hare Krishna, you are Hare Krishna. And then you may say, no, no, not me. Look at me. Do I look like a Hare Krishna? When you're disguised. And they say, I know, you're Hare Krishna, you're shining. And one devotee was telling me, it may even be in that Prabhupada, that collection of Prabhupada nectar books, those red books, that at the New York Rath Yatra, I think it was 76, then this devotee was standing at the beginning before they started, and he was just standing there, and there are a couple of New York cops there. Those of you who are familiar with New York would know what a New York cop is like. Yes, they're real heavy characters, but also friendly characters in their own little ways. So there are these couple of New York cops sort of hanging out, waiting for the festival to start, and the devotees standing next to them. And then Srila Prabhupada came. He was driven in for the beginning of the Rath Yatra, and Prabhupada got out of the car, and the cops were hanging out, just sort of, you know, wasting time. And then they saw Prabhupada. And one of them, it was like he got a shock. He grabbed the other one and said, Hey, look at that man. He's glowing. Srila Prabhupada. Because he was reflecting Krishna's presence in his heart so much. So Krishna is so effulgent that if you see him and you're not a devotee, then chances are you'll just see this blazing effulgence. Actually. And this point is made or illustrated in the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam when Krishna left Vrindavan and went to Mathura, and then he entered the wrestling arena. Then different people saw him in different ways at exactly the same time. The young ladies who were devotees, they saw him as being like a transcendental Cupid. Those who were elderly or older, more mature, they saw him as, and Balaram, as very delicate little boys who needed to be protected from these big heavy wrestlers. And the wrestlers saw Krishna and Balaram as death. And there were some impersonalists. It's described there. There were some impersonalists there. And there were also some yogis, Ashtanga yogis, who realized Paramatma. So they saw these four-armed forms walking across the arena. And the impersonalists, what did they see? They saw like these lights. Yes, it's described in the Bhagavad. They saw these lights moving across the wrestling arena. So, actually Krishna's body is extremely effulgent. And when a person becomes Brahman realized, what it means, really, is that they have realized Krishna. In a sense, they've realized Krishna. Because the Brahman and Krishna, they are the same. Brahmeti, Paramatmeti, Bhagavan, iti shabjate. This is non-dual. This is the one absolute truth. But realized in different aspects by people in terms of their different conditions. So Brahman realization means you realize Krishna. It's not something else. But because you haven't got the bhakti, then you only see the effulgence. You don't see the form. You don't see the personality. So Brahman realization means realization of Krishna minus his form and minus his personality. But when a person has bhakti, then they get special eyes, and those eyes can see through the effulgence and see Krishna. And actually this is essentially what this devotee is asking for here, that I want to see you, I want to meet you. I've dedicated, he says as we go through the other verses, he's saying, I've dedicated my whole life to you. So now, please, I want to gain your association by your mercy. So in 15 and 16 then, he's asking the same question twice, basically, or making the same request. Please remove the effulgence so I can see you. In 16, he's asking or making that request in a little stronger way. Same request, but a little stronger. And he's appealing to Krishna by glorifying him in certain aspects. Aspects of Krishna in which he manifests his mercy. Primeval philosopher. In other words, the source of knowledge. Maintainer of the universe and of us. Regulating principle. One who's the controller of everything, including me. Destination of the pure devotees. My destination, he's saying. And well-wisher of the progenitors. And of everyone, actually. So the difference between 15 and 16, it appears there's no difference in one sense, because the same request is being made, but there is a difference in the sense of the intensity of the request. He's really trying to elicit a response from Krishna by appealing to Krishna in terms of his mercy, how he's merciful in different situations. So 15 and 16, he's praying in basically the same way. Then in 17, he's asking the Lord that take this body. Just take this body. He's at the time of death. Prabhupada explains that in the purport. He's at the time of death, and he knows it. So he's saying, just take this body. Take this body now. And so that's one request. And please remember what I've done. Remember all my sacrifices. And remember everything I've done for you. So you might think, you know, he's taking a bit of a chance. We're not meant to ask Krishna. But why not? At the time of death, I mean, what can you do? What can you do? You just gotta... And then he does it. Right at the end, he just throws himself at the feet of the Lord. And he makes two requests. Lead me on the right path, which Prabhupada in the purport explains, a little indirectly, but it seems he's explaining the point that if I have to take birth again, if I'm not qualified, then lead me on the right path so I can become qualified in time. And then finally, free me from my sins. He's not claiming that, yes, I'm very pure and sinless and, you know, I'm a great devotee. He's saying, yes, I'm a sinful soul. What can I say about myself? But you are the great purifier. So seeing I've tried, all my life I've tried. So please, at this last moment, perhaps you can just forgive me for my sins. So very humble and... You know, there's a lot of feeling going into these mantras. Very, very, very wonderful, actually. Very, very nice. So 15 and 16, we already mentioned a bit. The basic point is that he's asking to be able to see the form of the Lord. He wants to meet the Lord in person and not be dazzled by the Brahmajyoti. Prabhupada, and of course we mentioned that in 16, he's appealing to the Lord by referring to him in different aspects of the Lord's nature, different aspects in which he is merciful. And Srila Prabhupada, on page 94, he quotes Jiva Goswami's Bhagavat Sandarbha, in which Jiva Goswami analyzes the term Bhagavan. You'll see there towards the bottom of page 94, at least in my book. He says that Va, the first syllable, means one who fully maintains, and guardian. And the second letter, Ga, means guide, leader, or creator. And Va indicates that everything, every being lives in him, and he lives in every being. Then over the top of the next page, Prabhupada explains how this applies in this context. That the Lord maintains his unalloyed devotees, that's Ba. And he guides them progressively on the path of devotional perfection, that's Ga. He is the leader of the devotees, and as the leader of the devotees, he ultimately awards them the desired result, which is himself. So that's Ga also. Then being the creator, a few lines further down, being the creator, which is also Ga, he can, interesting application of the concept of creator, being the creator, he can bestow all necessary qualifications upon his devotee, so that the devotee can ultimately reach him. He can make you qualified, even if you're not, as the speaker is presenting himself, and it's a pretty wise idea to have this idea in our minds about ourselves. Krishna says that in Bhagavad Gita that for my devotees I carry what they lack and preserve what they have. And if you feel that you're qualified, then Krishna will feel, oh, well, you don't need any help from me, do you? You've already made it yourself. But actually it's a good idea to always keep the idea very clearly in the mind that I'm really not qualified, and pray to Krishna to make up, preserve anything which may be worthwhile in terms of qualification that I have, and make up for any shortcomings. So then mantra 17, this is quite a powerful mantra. He is at the point of death. Prabhupada, on page 101, discusses the specific situation of this devotee, and any devotee who comes to the point of death, or just in principle, the time of death, and how the Lord may relate to the devotee. In this page 101, the second paragraph, in this mantra, the living entity prays to enter the spiritual kingdom of God after relinquishing his material body and material ear. The devotee prays to the Lord to remember his activities and the sacrifices he's performed before his material body is turned into ashes. This prayer is made at the time of death, with full consciousness of one's past deeds and of the ultimate goal. One who is completely under the rule of material nature remembers the heinous activities performed during the existence of his material body, and consequently gets another material body. And Prabhupada quotes Bhagavad Gita. And then we turn over the page, Prabhupada makes a most interesting point. He says, unlike the simple animals who have no developed mind, the animals are not really meditating so much. They don't really have such a developed mind. But unlike them, the human beings, they have very active minds. The human being can remember the activities of his passing life like dreams at night. Therefore, his mind remains surcharged with material desire. And consequently, he cannot enter into the spiritual kingdom with a spiritual body. However, the devotees develop a sense of love for God by practicing devotional service to the Lord. Even if a devotee does not remember his godly service at the time of death, the Lord does not forget him. This prayer is given to remind the Lord of the devotee's sacrifices. But even if there is no such reminder, the Lord does not forget the devotional service of his pure devotee. I was with His Holiness Harikesh Swami once, years ago, and it was 1978, just after Srila Prabhupada left. He came over to England and we were going and doing university programs. So one day we were driving up the M1 and the car broke down and it was pouring with rain, pouring with rain. So I told Maharaj, I said, I think we better pray to Krishna. Stuck out in the middle of nowhere. And he said, no, we're not going to pray to Krishna. We don't want to bother Krishna. Have him serve us. Ask him to serve us. We're not going to do that. So we just sat there as the rain poured. And about 5:04, just a couple of minutes later, he wound down his window, leant his head out the window and shouted out, Krishna, help! So, you know, in a sense you don't need to. You can just carry on all very cool, calm and collected. You know, death is coming right on your head and no problem. Or else, as this devotee is doing, you can just call out, Krishna, help. So it's probably a pretty good practice to get into. Yeah. So then Srila Prabhupada goes on the next couple of pages, more or less, over the rest of page 102 and through most of page 103, by explaining how Krishna is extremely merciful. He's really very, very, very merciful. First of all, he refers to Bhagavad Gita chapter 9 verses 30 to 34. You all familiar with those verses? Bhagavad Gita scholars, have you reached chapter 9 yet? Apichet sudaracharo bhajate mam ananivak sadur eva samantavya samyag vyavasatohisa. Krishna is saying that even if my devotee does something most abominable, very, very, extremely abominable, but he remains attached to devotional service and struggling on, trying to hang in there, then sadhur eva, he must be considered a sadhu, a saintly person, because he is rightly situated in his determination. And then shipram bhavati dharmatma shashvas chantam nagachati kanteya pratijanihi name bhakta pranashyati, that you declare it boldly, Arjuna, that my devotee never perishes. I think when those of you at least who are doing the Bhagavad Gita course, when you get to that point, I think that Mother Narayani will read some of the commentaries of some of our previous acharyas where they elaborate on the theme. And they make it clear that Krishna is prepared, he's very, very kind to someone who's trying to hang in there. Someone who they fall down or something bad happens and they just give up and go away, that's another thing. But someone who even falls down but they're struggling to hold on and carrying on regardless, then Krishna's very, very kind. Extremely kind. Such thing, sudur achar, means, Prabhupada translates, most abominable. Something which normally you would go to hell for, actually. You'd actually go to hell. Not just you make a little mistake here and there, but something terribly serious. So normally, for something sudur acha, very, very bad, you would go to hell. But if you're a devotee, what happens? Then you get Krishna's mercy and you don't go to hell. But actually you become righteous and then you go back to Godhead by his grace. So just see, Krishna makes such an exception with his devotees. It's an extremely important fact. Then Srila Prabhupada quotes Bhaktivinoda Thakur's purport on one of these verses. And I thought we should, maybe I'll just quickly read it. One should accept a devotee who's on the right path of the saints, even though such a devotee may seem to be of loose character. One should try to understand the real purport of the words, loose character. So now he's going to explain. When you see a devotee who's in a mixed position, doing some devotional service, but doing some maya also. A conditioned soul has to act for double functions, namely for the maintenance of the body and, again, for self-realization. Social status, mental development, cleanliness, austerity, nourishment, and the struggle for existence are all for the maintenance of the body. The self-realization part of one's activities is executed in one's occupation as a devotee of the Lord. And one performs action in that connection also. These two different functions parallel one another. They're going on simultaneously. Because a conditioned soul cannot give up the maintenance of his body. The proportion of activities for maintenance of the body decreases, however, in proportion to the increase in devotional service. As long as the proportion of devotional service does not come to the right point, there is a chance for an occasional exhibition of worldliness. But it should be noted that such worldliness cannot continue for any length of time because, by the grace of the Lord, such imperfections will come to an end very shortly. Therefore, the path of devotional service is the only right path. If one is on the right path, even an occasional occurrence of worldliness does not hamper one in the advancement of self-realization. Isn't that encouraging? Doesn't mean that you can now think, fine, now I can do that material thing that's been sort of haunting me all these years, and then just quote this statement to people. But we should look on others, devotees who are struggling but sticking at it. We should look at them in this light. Sadhu or Eva. They're saintly people. They may have some serious problem. Doesn't mean we gloss over the fact that they may actually have some really serious problem. But we should have that confidence that if they stick at it, then in course of time, the worldliness will decrease and the Krishna consciousness will increase. As long as they stick at it, devotional service. In this respect, there's also one extremely interesting passage in the sixth canto about Ajamil, right at the end of the narration of his pastimes, or whatever you'd call them. And I assume you are all familiar with Ajamil, so I don't have to explain who he is, but he chanted the name Narayan at the time of death, and even though he had really had a bad life, but he was liberated and shortly after went back to Godhead. So Prabhupada, right at the end of the second chapter, Prabhupada quotes Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, who is summarizing the whole Ajamil incident, and there's not really time to read the whole thing, and it's rather long also, but the point is that a person may think, that because Ajamil chanted the name Narayan at the end of his life, he was liberated. But Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that this is true in a sense, but not exactly. The fact that he initially named his son Narayan was actually what caused it, was the main factor. Just the fact that he spoke the name Narayan one time at that point, that was the main factor. Isn't that interesting? I mean, perhaps you should read the whole thing, but I'll just read the last bit where it's being summed up. Ajamil unconsciously accumulated the results of bhakti by chanting through the course of his life, or in the later part at least when he was calling the name of Narayan. Indeed, even his first utterance of the holy name was sufficient to nullify all the sinful reactions of his life. To cite a logical example, a fig tree does not immediately yield fruits, but in time the fruits are available. Similarly, Ajamil's devotional service grew little by little, and therefore, although he committed very sinful acts, the reactions did not affect him. In the Shastras, it is stated that if one chants the holy name of the Lord even once, the reactions of past, present, or future sinful life do not affect him. Future sinful life. To give another example, if one extracts the poison fangs of a serpent, this saves the serpent's future victims from poisonous effects, even if the serpent bites repeatedly. Similarly, if a devotee chants the holy name even once, inoffensively, this protects him eternally. He need only wait for the results of the chanting to mature in due course of time. I know what you think of that, but I find it very encouraging. The general mood here is encouragement, I think. Okay. And then Prabhupada concludes Mantra 17, the purport, by explaining that we should practice in the meantime. Just try our best practicing in the meantime. And then Mantra 18. It appears on page 109, it appears that Prabhupada is explaining this verse where the devotee is saying, please guide me, lead me on the right path, and do something about my sins so they don't hinder me in the future. It appears that Prabhupada is looking on this statement as though the devotee is thinking, well, I may have to take birth again. But if that's the case, then, you know, please help me to carry on in the right way. On page 109, the second paragraph, Prabhupada says in Bhagavad Gita 6:41 and 6:42, we are assured by the Lord that the yoga brashtas, or souls fallen from the path of self-realization, are given a chance to rectify themselves by taking birth either in the families of good Brahmins or in the families of rich merchants. Such births afford higher chances for self-realization. Of course, if these chances are misused due to illusion, one loses the good opportunity of human life afforded by the Almighty Lord. Therefore, he's asking the Lord, please guide me. Lead me on the right path. Don't just, you know, stick me in my next birth and say, you know, see you later. But keep guiding me on. And there's a very nice, in Ramayana, there's one very nice statement of Lord Ramachandra, which actually is quoted by Rupa Goswami in Nectar of Devotion. And Prabhupada quotes on a couple, two or three or four occasions in different places. In that statement, Lord Ram says that if a person once says that, my dear Lord, from this day on, I'm yours, then I'll never forget that person. So that is quoted by Rupa Goswami and Srila Prabhupada. The context was that Vibhisan abandoned Ravan and came to join Lord Ram before Ram crossed to Lanka. He was waiting on the beach. And Vibhisan came flying over in some Vedic flying machine, and Hanuman saw him came running to Lord Ram and told him, look, it's Vibhisan. Let's kill him. I'll get all the men, all the monkeys with our clubs, and as soon as he lands, we'll just jump on him, and that'll be that. The only good demon is a dead demon. So Lord Ram said, no, no, no. Just wait. Just wait. And we'll see. See what he has to say. There's only one of him. He can't really do much. So let's just wait. And Hanuman was saying, no, come on. Just let me kill him, that's all. And we don't have to worry about it. But Ram was saying, no, no, you just wait. You be quiet and wait. Getting a little angry, actually. And, just a sec. Then Vibhishan landed and Hanuman was saying, come on, you know, you gotta let me kill him. And Ram was getting angry that you be quiet. And Vibhishan spoke to him. And afterwards Hanuman came to Ram and said, he's probably lying. I know what he says sounds good. He wants to join you and all this. He's probably lying. Let's just kill him anyway. And then Lord Ram spoke this verse. And he said that Hanuman, even if Ravana himself came and surrendered to me, I'd immediately accept him. And then he spoke the verse, that any person who comes to me and says, my Lord, from this day I'm yours, then I, from that point on, I will never forget this person. So, like this, Lord Ram, Lord Krishna, they're very, very merciful, and the speaker of Ishapanishad is taking that into account here and appealing for some mercy from the Lord. And I think it would do us good to also follow in his footsteps, try and cultivate that mood of humble surrender. Okay, well, that's about it, really, for Sri Ishapanishad, from my side at least. Any comments or questions? You wanted to say something, Bill?
There was Sugriva, sorry.
Okay. Very aggressive. The only good demon is a dead demon. Never believe what they say.
Yeah. Hanuman was the friend of Vibhishan.
Ah, okay. Any other comment or question? Okay. Oh, Mataji? Ishapanishad is one of the personified Vedas. Well, is that what you're saying? It's a sage. Well, actually, it's eternal. But it's just that different sages incarnate every time. They appear, they disappear because of the material world being what it is. So then the same sage may come and repeat the same part, like Valmiki, for example. Yeah. Ramayana has been existing all that time, but Valmiki, when it disappeared, then Valmiki manifested it again. But the personified Vedas, well, yes, anyway, I don't know exactly, you know, what that means, to tell you the truth. Whether it was the sages who speak the different parts, whether they were assembled and reciting all their different verses and so on, or whether it was some other entities who are like the actual Vedas. As far as I understand, it was like that. The personalities of the Vedas and the sages and so on, they're like serving these personalities or acting as via mediums for them by manifesting them. Yeah. Is that okay? Something. What did you?
When
where's that? Oh, right, okay, yeah. When the world was full of water, the living entity took an aquatic form.
Oh yes, Darwin. It's Charles Darwin.
Anyway, the thing is that living entities, from the human form, they generally fall down, unfortunately. That's the general procedure, samsara. Human means up. And then Prabhupada explains that after you've incurred enough karma, yeah, so that's what Prabhupada's referring to here. You might have to fall down to an aquatic form, and then vegetable, then reptile, I guess, then bird, then animal, then human, through the system of the 8,400,000 species, starting with the lowest position first. Am I referring to what you're referring to? Oh, I see. I guess when you're a fish, the world is full of water. You know, it's not that Srila Prabhupada is really in the practice of talking in these terms. I don't know of any other place where Prabhupada is using this type of terminology. So I would, although he talks about, you know, the cycle of samsara and going down and coming up through the species on many, many occasions. So maybe he's just speaking in a kind of like rhetorical way, or, you know, just in like a manner of speaking, something like that. I think that's all I could say, at least. I wouldn't want to speculate too much. Okay, so we'll all gather here at 10:30 tomorrow, and we'll wish you all good luck with the test, and thank you for being good students, and Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.